You are now listening to a member of the Disney Podcast family. Head over to Disney Podcast Family on Instagram to see all the latest posts for this show and links to other great Disney podcasts.
Welcome, dreamers and believers. You're listening to Imagine That, a Light in the Window production.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Imagine That. We are glad you can join us. For those of you that are just joining us, though, you may want to hit pause because we are going to get into our second tier of the pyramid of Imagineering. So if you have not heard tier one, you want to pause this, go back and listen to episode one. So that way you are caught up on the journey we are doing. But before that, let's introduce our host. Sam, how are you doing?
I am all right. We're dumping everything we've got into this tier. So let's go.
Absolutely.
Are you ready, Liz?
Absolutely. Oh, I'm ready. Kevin, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Looking forward to diving into this guy. You said go back to episode one, but it was like episode four. Which episode are we on now? I keep losing count every episode.
It's five now. So we actually, you would want to go back to episode three. Where we introduced the first tier. Episode four, we did some armchair imagineering based off of the first pyramid role, the first layer of the pyramid. And now tonight we're going to delve into the second tier of the pyramid. But before that, Amanda, how's Amanda?
Hello, I'm doing well.
Good.
It's been a whirlwind of a day, and I'm really excited to, like, just stop with the go of the day and be able to get my creative juices flowing and
cap it off with us. Yes, it off with us. Lewis, the reason I asked if you were ready is because the last time we recorded over a tier of the pyramid, you kept saying it was a pyramid scheme. Are you still feeling that way after consuming more of the content?
I didn't think it was a scheme, but just the flow of words calling it the pyramid scheme just seemed so natural. Like I couldn't stop saying it. Like, there was no rhyme or reason for calling it a pyramid scheme. It just, that's how the words were flowing. So I am ready. I hope I am ready to support the topic I am talking about. Because doing the homework and the research, I have yet to buy the book, so I apologize on that. But I went down the rabbit hole of reading up on why my topic is called what it's called and the intent that Walt goes behind it. But I'm excited. I am excited for this pyramid project.
Pyramid project. I love that. Okay, so
to follow up on that real quick, Lewis, if you recall, was adamant that the first tier should be at the top of said pyramid. But now we're in tier two.
So let's see if he understands what a pyramid is at this point and why there's a foundational baseline before you get to the top of the pyramid. Because we are working our way up. Are you ready?
You know, I hope so, because now I'm second guessing myself.
So, but
I'm always ready.
So in this pyramid tier, we are going to be talking, and just to recap,
are we recapping? I thought we were going to go into our first subjects.
Well, oh, okay. We can do that.
No, first. You take the lead.
I was just going to say, since we were talking about the pyramid that we would be discussing today, we are going to be talking about weenies, transitions, storyboards, pre-shows, and post-shows. And we are getting our material from the Imagineering Pyramid book from Lou Prosperi. So when we get into that part of our show, that is where that material is coming from. And those are going to be the topics that we will be dividing up and taking and kind of presenting as our topics tonight. But we do have more Imagineering content to discuss before that. Lewis?
So Joe Rohde, see, I got it there, went stumbling back to the Walt Disney Imagineering building today, posted a pretty cool video. He also posted a pretty cool clip that Joey, our co-host in the main show, shared about his D23 award. He's hoping to put his ear in the Legends. So if you're familiar with Legends, they put their hands, they sign into the concrete. But Joe is looking to try to up that by putting his ear. And if you know who Joe Rohde is, you know that that ear is infamous. But he wandered back to Walt Disney Imagineering today, which I'm stoked for. But I wanted to get your guys' opinions, feedback. What do you guys speculate that's for? Based on just the looking at the video, if you saw the video, what do you think it's for before venturing down the rabbit hole of what the rumors are coming out to be?
So what do I hope it's for?
Sure.
Because that's going to lead me into one of our other topics tonight. What I hope it's for.
Okay.
Because I would love to see him stepping into a larger role in Imagineering, personally. But before we jump into the speculation and what has been stated for why he was there, that is where I was. Anytime I see him doing anything with Imagineering, I hope he's coming back and coming back in a much larger role. Personally, that's my want.
I thought the same thing, especially I think too, because we left last episode with our homework of picking two individuals. And so with this news, we're like, could it be? And so that obviously remains to be seen. However, my brain also went to our conversation about New Pandora. And who better knows the world of Pandora than Joe Rohde? So I
was going to say, it always amazes me to watch Kevin's face, because I just assume that like Kevin and Amanda, because they're like married, are always in each other's head. So when Kevin makes a face, he's like, oh, she was thinking that. I was like, wait, you guys didn't talk about this beforehand. This is fresh. It makes me excited. I feel like I'm part of the magic here.
Yeah. We like go through the book together, but in terms of like who our top two are for our next discussion topic, we have not discussed. Mm. So
I love that. But even just when Disney news comes out and you guys discuss it, obviously you share it with each other, and or we're all sharing it together in our group chats. And for you to have that thought about New Pandora, and for Kevin to be like, oh, right now on our show, that was exciting to me. I was like, wait, did I just get like a first row seat to the inside of Amanda's brain?
My head went to how they're talking about adding on to Animal Kingdom. So I thought that would make sense for him to be there to help them with like whatever they're planning to do with the whole Indiana Jones and Encanto, or whatever they're actually going to do with that whole whatever the tropical area of Animal Kingdom. I didn't even think about improving Pandora for California, and that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. But going down the rabbit hole, as Lou was saying, they say that he was actually there for a master class where he's going to be teaching younger Imagineers. What? We don't know, because we're not Imagineers. We're not in the room where it happens. We don't know. But
can I just say that would be a great role for a CCO?
Yeah.
To be teaching master classes for younger Imagineers.
Makes sense.
I think to your point, he needs to be more involved for sure. And the fact that even if it's just for one master class, how transformational that master class is going to be on the future of those Imagineers. So I think that is it. It makes my heart so happy for the future of the company. Just to see him walk through the door. Like,
and he has the kind of creative drive that we're looking for in Imagineering. And the fact that he is being called upon to lead future Imagineers who hopefully have the same spark that he came into Imagineering with is a very, very, very good sign. And it's awesome for us because it gives us longevity on this show. We're going to have new things. I would love to be a fly on the wall in one of those sessions and just pick his brain, or really any of the Imagineering Disney legends. Like, just pick their brains and magic.
Absolutely.
So, Lou, what do you think?
As far as him putting his ear in the plaster, over on his Instagram, when he first posted that he was, you know, one of those that is going to be inducted into the Legends ceremony, he had posed that question of like, how do I incorporate the ear? And I went in as we're in the park and I responded to the question of why not both the hands and the ear? Because there are so many Imagineers, or not just Imagineers, but Legends who have additional things other than just their handprints. So I think that he should absolutely incorporate his ear somehow. I don't know the logistics of that at all or how messy that would be, but
put the earring into it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, what they could do is take a 3D sculpt of his ear and press it in, but then it's not as authentic. What I would say is take, during the ceremony, take a piece of the earring off and press it in to the legend, the plaster.
Like, I think it needs to be the whole ear, though.
Like, oh, it absolutely does.
Yeah.
Just take one for the team, Joe. Put Slimer face in there real quick. And
yeah. I think he'll do it.
I think he will, possible. Too. Actually, speaking of his ear, do any listeners that have a 3D printing machine, if you can mock up a 3D printed version of Joe Rohde's ear, reach out to me on my Instagram. I might be interested in that. It'd be like Tony Stark's heart, but instead it's just Joe Rohde's ear.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. Can we not?
Where are you going to put that ear, Lou?
What's that?
Where are you going to put that ear?
I mean,
Oh, no. You haven't thought that far ahead. Okay, you're just requesting it. All right. You'll figure it out.
What I would do is I would mount it somewhere or put like, okay, real quick, off the rail, imaginary idea. Take a giant paintbrush 3D sculpture, but the handle of it has that ear kind of sculpted into it. Or have a paintbrush with the paint dripping and it's kind of showing that ear. I don't know. I'm getting a little far down the rabbit hole on that one.
So it's like a statue, or are you going to like put this on the wall?
I don't know. I might just make a cosplay, put an old 70s sweatband around my forehead and just slap it on the side of my head as I'm caught. No, I'm just kidding. I would probably hang it on the wall. That'd be really pretty cool.
Okay. Right. I hang it from the ceiling.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that went weird fast, but...
fill it back in.
It was kind of like our warm-up episode. Or a warm-up talk. Yeah. But speaking of Rohde, we've kind of been teasing at it. Do you want to get into our second subject of the evening regarding Imagineers and what they can do for the company?
Yeah.
So we posed a challenge to each other last show, and it was our Rushmore, our top two, who would be president and CCO of the company, and they had to be alive. They could not be no longer with us. Right. I was joking that I had 3.5. I still have 3.5, and now I'm going to narrow it down. I'm pretty sure I'm going to get canceled for one of them, but who wants to start us off? I'm going to go last.
I will. Lou's not going to like this, but I say for president, I would go with the man who's been leading the parks, Josh Giammaro. And because I feel he has the business sense that we said needed to be in the presidency, but he also appreciates the parks enough to allow Imagineers creative liberties. And that's when you bring in Joe Rohde to be CCO, because he has, what? Louis, why are you making that face? This is my Mount Rushmore.
I'm just making a face.
I know it is the most bizarre combination, but maybe that's what we need, is two people who are going to like play against each other and bring different strengths in.
Okay.
And I think Josh Giammaro has enough respect for the creativity of Joe Rohde to not challenge him as much. And that's what we need, is less challenge towards our CCO and our Imagineers, because they already challenged themselves and each other.
I'm smiling now because I know you're going to challenge mine then.
Okay.
Knowing that you went that route, I know that you're going to just despise mine. But I mean, I don't think they're bad choices. If anything, it's just a combo. I'm like, that's an interesting combo, and I want it to happen to see what would happen from it.
So I'll go next because half of mine is in alignment with Sam. So I also went Josh DeMauro because he's learned from the Bobs, right? He's learned from others, and I think he's already being groomed to assume that role, right? So I think with a creative by his side to run that team, I was thinking Kim Irvine. Yeah. And because of her background, she's been really involved in, you know, with the Imagineering story and all of that. So she has a different level of appreciation that I think others might not have that help make her qualified for the position. But I think that that would be an interesting duo.
That's a very good
interesting
one.
Thought. Yeah. Curious how that would work out. For me, I went a little, I don't know. We'll see. I don't know about company wide. I think this would work better for like just an Imagineering Mount Rushmore personally, but possibly. My top two would be Kevin Rafferty and Robert Coltrane. They're both ex-Imagineers now, mm-hmm. but they work together on multiple projects, including Cars Land and I don't know. The list goes on. You could read the book. Kevin Rafferty actually has a book called Magic Journey, My Fantastical Walt Disney Imagineering Career, where he goes into detail of kind of how he started as a dishwasher over at the Plaza Inn in Disneyland. And his career went all the way until he retired after Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway. And I love the way he goes into detail about how when he works with people outside of the company or outside of the Imagineering division, he has to kind of reel them in and explain to them how would the parks work. And he seems like he's really unlocked the magic of like what makes something work in the parks versus what works in the rest of the world, you know, which is why I think that he'd be great to have in charge. Whereas Robert Coltrane is the guy, he's actually a portrait in Mystic Manor in Hong Kong, where he's labeled as Professor, I might be mispronouncing this, but Blauer Himmel. And that translates to blue sky, because he's the guy that they bring in at the beginning of projects to kind of get the ball turning on them. He's the guy who makes ideas come true, essentially, which is why I think he'd be a great creative officer for the company.
Man, Kevin Rafferty, that's a good one. I sometimes forget about him, unfortunately, just because he's a great Imagineer, but I think sometimes he's like one of those actors where it's like, you know, there's actors you know, you've seen them in plenty of movies, and you always just forget their name. Kevin Rafferty's one of those guys where it's like, you know, he's done a lot, but he just slips through the cracks. Like, oh.
Kind of the underdog. Which
yeah.
I like him.
And it sucks because he shouldn't be. He's got a huge report card. I mean, the way we talk about Gurr and Baxter, he should be up there with them. Yeah. So I have 3.5, but my two. I'm going Bob Weiss as president. I really think the way he managed Imagineering when he was, you know, the head, I think that could easily be translated company-wide. I mean, he was overseas creating parks. He was doing stuff here in the States creating parks. So he's able to have 10 fingers in 11 holes. Like, all right, he's just able to make it work and figure it out. Now, chief creative officer, and I know I'm going to get backlash, and I have a response. I'm going John Lasseter. He was never found guilty. There was accusations. There was no founding guilty. But, I mean, who are we kidding? I mean, the storytelling in Pixar, up until he left, was top-notch. I mean, I know Sean hates it, but the robot had no words, and people love WALL-E. I get it. There's the the situations, but he was never found guilty. I mean, if Johnny Depp wasn't found guilty, I mean, I feel like everyone gets a second chance at something. So for me, it's Bob Weiss as the president and John Lasseter as chief creative officer. Will it happen? Absolutely not. But those are my two.
Who are your others?
Well, John Lasseter was my half one.
Okay.
So obviously, you can't go all in. You can't go all in on him. My other one was Rhodey and then Baxter. Baxter was a complete fangirl pick. It was absolutely no rhyme or reason. And I think he's just he has a unique way of creating things. And just in a few handful of interviews I have watched, I've never met him in person. He does seem like the type that if you go against the grain, he's not happy with it. But Joe Rhodey, I think, goes against the grain, but you know his style, which then puts kind of Disney in a box where I think Joe Rhodey is a very good Imagineer, but I couldn't see him creating something like a fantasy land or something like that. It's very, how do we adapt this to what's happening today? And Disney is very much built on three pillars. You have that futuristic vibe, that fantasy vibe, and the historical vibe. And Joe Rhodey doesn't play in the fantasy vibe. Now we see Pandora's probably the extent, but Pandora still got replicated to be something that if this was here, what does it look like? So for me, Joe Rhodey, I think, would be a solid chief creative officer, but we would end up in a tunnel vision. So Joe Rhodey and Tony Baxter are my other two.
Very interesting picks.
Yeah.
Except for Lasseter.
That's a
bet. I meant all around. I meant everybody. Good picks.
I mean, everybody. I wasn't there. I don't know. I never saw anything personally, but from what I've read and what seems.
In my minor defense, and I'm not trying to protect Lasseter, but at the same time, Pixar, y'all got to grow up. Stop having cereal bars in your job and expect people not to act like children. I mean, Walt had this issue in the later days of animation. It became very childlike and it caused problems. I mean, you look at Waking Sleeping Beauty's castle and they're sliding down linoleum on the original Disney cells. Like, when you create childlike aspects, there are childlike actions that happen. Granted, those actions that he did is the accusations, whatever that may be. I'm with Kevin. I wasn't there. Those aren't very childlike. But you do got to have some grown-up in there, and having things like a cereal bar does not create that aspect. So that's my minor.
What kind of breakfast would you prefer they provide?
Well, I mean, you do pastries. I mean, you do a lot of things. I mean, you do a breakfast bar.
Like an omelet bar. Omelet bar probably would be.
Omelet bar, I mean. But a cereal bar, allowing everyone to ride around on scooters, I get it gets that creative juices going. But if you build a playground, you have playground mentality. And I think there's got to be a little bit of both. So now for the animators, by all means. But for your business side of it, your president, stuff like that, that stuff should be left on the back burner because it's not your role to be the fun, cool guy. You got to play that happy medium. And that's one of the things I like about Iger 1.0 is he played both sides very well. Not anymore. But that's not this show. So, but before we get into our second tier of the pyramid program, you just want to take a quick break and hear from one of our sponsors?
Yes, please.
Do it.
All right. Here we go.
Where in the Park Seek and Find Image Scavenger Hunt games will have you exploring theme parks like never before. But this is not like your childhood scavenger hunts. There are no word-based lists of items to find or a binder of riddles, trivia, math, or counting. Our games contain cards with images of details that can be found throughout the park just by walking around. You can play on your own schedule, so you don't have to worry about long lines, height requirements, or health concerns. Need help finding an image? We've got you covered, with hints and answers on each card so you're never left wondering where in the park the image can be found. Use the Scan Before Playing card to reveal an alternate image if one of the cards in your pack is currently hidden or removed from the park. Order today to get game packs for your next visits to the Disneyland Resort and Walt Disney World theme parks. But the fun doesn't stop there. We also have games for Universal Studios in Hollywood and Florida, Knott's Berry Farm, Six Flags, SeaWorld, and more. Ready to experience your favorite theme parks in a whole new way? Go to www.whereintheparkcom/waltzaptpodcasts to get 10% off your order. A portion of the sale will also go to support the Waltz Apartment Podcast. Want $10 off your order instead? Visit patreon.com/waltzaptpodcast to become a lamplighter. With so much more to discover, the only question is, do you know where in the park?
We do know we're in the park. For those that are not familiar, Kevin and Amanda are we're in the park. And we know them very well. They are here on the show with us today. Try not to be too aggressive. Kevin called me out on Wednesday.
That's true. I did. It was very sweet. I appreciate it.
I was trying.
We make these games. You heard about it. It's great.
Every time I watch the ad, I learn more about it. Like, obviously, firsthand failed at the you can scan to get, you know, farther in and know what you're doing. Didn't do that. I went in as a rookie.
We try to provide instructions in a really big banner across the first card that says scan before playing. You didn't do either. So it's really hard
on our marketing. It's really what it is.
Way to go following directions, Lou.
You know,
and he didn't even reach out. He waited.
He's so excited, I think.
All day.
I've seen that a lot. A lot of people open the packet. They're so excited to see the cards. They just wanted to start playing. So.
I was excited, and I wanted redemption from that embarrassment that I had at my first attempt at wearing the park. So I was like, I got this. And I left the park realizing I don't got this. I mean, I did get one, but I mean, at the same time, if you don't know the plaque, are you really at Disneyland?
A lot of people don't know the plaque.
People don't know, yeah.
I don't get it.
No spoilers here, but yeah, there's a plaque in there that everybody should know that some people just don't. And that's kind of why we included, just to kind of nudge you into, hey, this is something that you should know. And if you don't, then go figure it out. It's going to be fun.
But, all right, you guys ready to dive into this first or second tier?
Absolutely. You want to take the lead on that one?
Yeah, sure. So the first tier... The first element of the first tier is weenies, which, Lou, that's you.
That is me. So, full disclosure, it's a term. It's not an actual anything like that. So,
there's no wrong being shown in the camera.
I just want to like make sure we share that, because if now hearing that people don't know about the plaque, and I'm like, well, then do they know what weenies are in the Disney sense? And real quick. To see who knows what it is. What is your favorite weenie at the park? We'll start with Kevin.
You know, I was trying to think. I mean, obviously the easy one's the castle. That's like the main one, the one that everyone thinks of. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking hard about it. I kind of go back to the loop on the Incredicoaster. It's kind of a weird thing that actually pulls me into that area of the park that nothing else really does over there. Because you have the big... the pal around, whatever, Mickey's Fun Wheel, the Sun Wheel, whatever you want to call it. They kind of, if you've been on it, it kind of makes you want to not go over to that area anymore, but because it's kind of the most intense ride in the entire park or the entire Disney theme park environment, I think, nationwide. But that loop, when you see it, it's actually kinetic, and I believe it's the only Disney loop you can see outdoors. Like, it's the only one you can actually walk around and go, hey, there's a looping coaster here at a Disney park. And yeah, so I like that one.
All right. Sam, your home park being Walt Disney World, what is your favorite weenie at the park?
Outside of the castle, I am going to say Big Thunder Mountain. Big Thunder Mountain is like the thing that pulls me into Frontierland. And it It has, like, there's not a lot of weenies, I feel, in Magic Kingdom that have such a large presence. Like, Spaceship Earth is, like, tucked in the corner, doesn't really pull you. There's nothing really pulling you into Tomorrowland. I know it's not actually tucked into a corner, but it doesn't pull me in. Like,
Spaceship Earth. Like, I think you meant Space Mountain.
Space Mountain. Oh my gosh. Okay. Space Mountain.
Like, Spaceship Earth is not tucked into any corner.
Spaceship Earth is literally a weenie in itself because of the giant golf ball, as Sean would call it. No, Space Mountain's like tucked into a corner, so to speak, like next to Tomorrowland Speedway, and it's eh. But nothing really pulls me into Tomorrowland. Fantasyland, like once you get to the, like behind the castle, like the other side of the castle, you've got all these cute little rides there that just have their own rights. And there's nothing that's directly like, I mean, I guess the castle wall does a good job over there, but I'm going to stick with Big Thunder Mountain, the actual mountain structure. It changes the feel of the land. And it's like, for me, what's pulling me into that space.
Yeah. The one over there is, you actually like can see it from a distance too, as you walk into the area. Whereas ours kind of like sneaks up to your right as you walk past it.
Okay. Yeah. So for, ours you can see. Ours you can see. I don't know. Is it the same way with your guys' Haunted Mansion? Because like our Haunted Mansion also does a decent job of like pulling you in.
Ours, depending on the size of the trees, can get kind of hidden. Otherwise, you can see it and it pulls you in.
Right now, it's not pulling anybody in because of the construction walls.
It's a giant weenie in the park.
Yeah. But as far as being able to see it from across Rivers of America, it does have that aura of foreboding, as some say, and draws you in. So, yeah, I can see that. For me, a couple stand out to me. In Disneyland proper, for me, it's the Matterhorn, because you can see the Matterhorn from a lot of different vantage points, whether you're looking for them or not, it is in your line of sight in areas where you don't expect it to be. And so that really draws me in that, oh, there's something else out there. You know, I might be in New Orleans Square and I can see Matterhorn Mountain, or I'm up in the Swiss Fam or Adventureland Treehouse and I can see Matterhorn. You know, so that really calls to me. At California Adventure, it's actually Mickey's Pal Around or the Pixar Pal Around. Even though I don't like the ride, I like what it symbolizes. And that is a lot of nostalgia for Kevin and I. That's where we met, is seeing that fun wheel at the World of Color show. So that image is very symbolic to me. And aww. Even though I don't care for the ride itself, I do like the wheel. So that draws me in.
I'll look at
it. The nostalgic for that. So yeah, those are my two.
So I was thinking about this question, knowing that I was going to ask it, and it's hard for me. Like, we're all park goers. And I feel like lately, the weenies don't stick out as much as they traditionally do. Like, I feel a lot of them are blurred. Like, the castle stuff. That the castle, before I was a Magic Key holder, would always pull me in. So, for me, I think the castle is still going to be, like, my favorite. Or the park icon that pulls me in. But more recently, it's the personal things. I think the partner statue, for me personally, I enjoy, I see that, and that gets me, hey, that's, I want to go down Main Street. I want to see the statue. Same statue in DCA with the storytelling statue. I see those. So, but for park icons, I would probably say it's the castle. Just can't beat it. But personal ones, I think the statues, the animation, the Disney Anna and the off the page stores, those things. But those are more personal reasons, enjoying those for what they are and how they are. So I would say
does that play into weenies then? And like the research that you did is like, does a sentimental value count as far as weenies go?
So a weenie by Imagineers and what Walt was saying is it's to pull you somewhere, to get your attention, but it's your attention, but also your curiosity.
So does that stop at the design factor and take people's personal experiences out of it? Like,
I think a weenie, very much like a traditional hot dog, is built with a lot of different ingredients. And hear me out. It's your own personal interest. It's your own.
As far as Imagineering goes, and they're designing weenies, they have to take these things into account to build this hot dog.
So, yeah, because all of these things, whether it's your personal interest, what might interest you on different ages. I mean, for some, for a young girl, the castle may be the weenie. But for a young boy, it may be the rocket ships that's the weenie. For a grandmother that's going, that just enjoys the look, it may be the flowers and the smell of fresh coffee down Main Street. So I think weenies are molded into they are meant to be park icons, but it's us as the viewers that make them the icon. I mean, there are plenty of people that post around the compass in the Esplanade between DCA and Disneyland. So imagine a Sunday, right? I got to stop making food references on these shows. It's really bad. So imagine a Sunday. The weenie in the Imagineer's eyes is the cherry on top. That's, you know, it's done. But us as the consumers of that Sunday, we may like the whipped cream. We may like the ice cream that was chosen. We may like the room temperature that the ice cream is, the bowl that the ice cream sitting in. We take it and then we're like, that's what we like. The cherry was what is intended by the Imagineers. So doing my homework on this, I've also learned that Imagineers themselves, park weenies, have also become, more recently, have become more of a signature for Imagineers than what they were intended for when Walt started there. I don't have my notes fully in front of me, just a few words typed, but I'll find out what Imagineer, but so how many of us have written Winnie the Pooh? Right? We've all written that.
Mine's a little different than yours, but yeah.
One Imagineer makes the reference that the moose, the buffalo from Country Bear.
Mm-hmm. No, that part's different.
It considers that a weenie and is curious that if Tony Baxter intended that to be, because you don't see it. But some Imagineers have looked to weenies as signatures of them putting a little touch of themselves in the ride. Yes, we know Tony Baxter did not create those three animatronics, but saying, hey, we're going to put those still in here and leave them in here. So how the weenies have also evolved from what Walt wanted them to be to what Imagineers wanted them to be. And now, granted, this is all research off the internet, not from the book, but I think weenies is a unique wild card in this pyramid. There is no real solid foundation for it. We know what storytelling is. We know what, far, close, and middle shots are. We know what those are. You can't really change that too much. A weenie, though, you don't know what that is. That could be anything from your perspective and what the Imagineers intended to do. So for me, I think weenies on this tier right now is probably the most unique, but also very exceptional piece of this because of the fact that a weenie could be anything. It could be a legit hot dog on Main Street. You could be thinking about corn dogs.
Let me interrupt for a second, because when Amanda started talking, I was thinking, you know what the actual weenie into Adventureland is for me? It's the egg roll cart. Because I'm thinking about cheeseburger egg rolls over here. So for you saying that, it wasn't, because it's like right over the bridge into Adventureland. Like, there's where the cheeseburger egg roll cart is.
Well, and in Disneyland, the hub. I mean, when you get to the hub, Tomorrowland has their signs now. But for the most part, it's the Rockets ride that seems to be the weenie that wants to go there. You see Space Mountain in the distance, but for the most part, it's the Rockets. You go to Fantasyland, and Fantasyland and Disneyland has two unique ones. And it's very much a, do you want to go left or do you want to go right? You have the castle, and you go through the castle, or you go to the right because you see Matterhorn. Adventureland and Frontierland, those two are fairly unique because all you see from there is their signs.
So there's that. I just realized I only thought about Magic Kingdom when I was thinking about. I was trying to make it fit in Magic Kingdom when I could have picked other parks.
Yeah, and see DCA. I think DCA does a better job at having natural weenies versus Disneyland, where it's almost you could tell what's leading, and that's because they go off the hub system, which is the hub itself is a weenie. You want to make your way down there to pick your next route. But yeah, so weenies are park icons intended to pull guests and keep allowing guests the flow of traffic and activities and attractions within the park.
So I'm going to change my answer and I'm going to say Tower of Terror.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess we have subjective weenies and objective weenies, right? You have ones that are obviously intended to be drawing you in, like the Tower of Terror, like the Tree of Life, like the floating mountains of Pandora, things that are big and they draw you to go toward them. Like all around the World Showcase, like there's always like a tall building that's going to kind of get you to go into that pavilion for the different worlds, but different countries of the world. But then, like you said, there are the subjective ones. There are the smells that are also weenies. The things that you don't think about, the things you might not even notice are happening that draw you into the park and keep you moving forward.
The smell of Pop Century.
Part of the magic. What was that?
The smell of Pop Century.
Pop Century. Is that a weenie? I mean, I don't.
I mean, the smell is. It makes me want to stand in the lobby.
Well, there you go. It's you know, like we like bypass the lobby.
Orangey vanilla smell.
I mean, yeah. You look at Small World. Small World's facade is a weenie. You see that facade, 100%. you're drawn to it. You're like, what is that?
Well, to be clear, in California, it's a weenie. In Florida, I don't know.
One in Florida, you can't see it all.
No. Yeah, it's a little hidden.
What? Oh, that's right. It's indoors.
Yeah, it's indoors in kind of tech way. You can see it. It just doesn't really draw you in the same way as.
That's why I was saying about Fantasyland. They're all like their own self-contained little.
But you guys still have like the throwback Fantasyland, right? Where it's like very like 3D pop-up book style.
Yeah.
Like how Disneyland's was.
Different sections over there. Because they have the Little Mermaid ride and the Mine Train that are.
Yeah, Seven Dwarfs Mine Train. They're
you have the like.
But as far as Peter Pan's Flight goes.
Small World. This is Fantasy Fair, Philhar Magic.
Yeah.
All of those, they look very flat and like it's a carnival almost.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. None of those really like draw you in. Like if you like you see the name and you're like, okay, I'll go there. But none of them are drawing you in because they're all just enclosed in their own self-contained buildings. And I mean, like even the Little Mermaid ride, you can miss it easily.
Well, I think, I know we talked about Galaxy's Edge a lot in the last few episodes of the show, and it feels like they kind of have been trying to turn the whole idea of weenies on its ear, you know, where you don't want to have it where you have something that draws you in, you want to have it where you explore and find things instead.
Right.
So it's kind of a, I don't know, it's like a surprise weenie, which I don't know if anyone's interested in that, you know.
Well, no one wants a surprise weenie. No. The other point that the book points out is that it's to Lou's point is that it doesn't have to be a tremendously large icon of the park. There are so many other things that can be considered a weenie. Like the book mentions Test Track, and you hear it before you see it, and your curiosity is piqued of like, whoa, what was that? What was that sound? I want to go explore that. So the sound of it draws you in. The music can draw you in. Which we'll talk about in the next section, but there's so many other things. It's not just what's something large in the park, you know.
And even each attraction, each ride system has its own weenies that get you through the ride.
Right.
They are telling, they're the main focal points of the story. But Amanda, you said in the next section, I think we're ready to move on because I believe transitions, which is the next part of this tier of the pyramid, is your section. Are you ready to talk to us about transitions?
I am. And I love transitions at Disney parks. And I don't know why. Maybe it's because we're always looking at the details of the parks, but especially when this section came up in the book, I was overjoyed because Disneyland, or not Disneyland, but Disney Total, like as a company, does a fantastic job at transitioning, not just in the parks, but in their movies as well. And you can transition from land to land. You can transition from ride to land, from parts of a ride to parts of a ride. You know, think the transitions in Pirates of the Caribbean is one of my favorite transitions in a ride, where you're going, at least in the California version, you're going from the Louisiana Bayou transitioning to skeletons, right? After the drop, you are in this grotto of skeletons. And then there's a fantastic transition between a skeleton and an animatronic figure, a human figure that has this fun magic trick. Won't spoil it if you haven't seen it, but it is the transition from all of the prior scenes of skeletons to the upcoming scenes where they're all human figures, the audio animatronics of human figures. So Pirates is a fantastic example of transitions within rides. Things that you can see just by walking around the parks is transition from land to land. And it's not just visual. There, a big tell is the concrete changes. It could be the scenery. You're going from different plants. Think Main Street versus going into Adventureland. You have a lot of wood and bamboo and natural versus wrought iron. There is one point that I have a sticking point that does not transition well in Disneyland that I will get to in just a second. But other things that help with the transition are music and smells, which we've alluded to a little bit ago. But they do a fantastic job at every Disney park fading out one stream of music and entering another section of music to complete that transition as you're walking along, to the point where you shouldn't even notice the transition unless you're a psychopath like me. So, but it's those subtle details that the Imagineers put together for our enjoyment. So it's not jarring. It shouldn't be like, and you're in Adventureland and go, unless it is an intentional transition. For example, the book uses the example of Figment, Journey into Imagination, where there is a section of the ride that is completely black. There's no light. That is done intentionally as a transition, as part of the ride. But it is used so sparingly that it works. If every ride did that, it wouldn't work, you know? But they use it very sparingly, so it works as a fantastic transition into the next scene. So I alluded to one point that does not transition well, and that is between Fantasyland, Frontierland, and Galaxy's Edge. And it is a sticking point for me because of our Halloween episode. Go back and listen to our Halloween takeover. But that there is a section back there, for those of you familiar with the Disneyland park, there is a gate that is beyond the Pinocchio bathrooms that should signal the transition into Frontierland. The pavement changes. You're now in a more wooded, natural environment leading into Frontierland. However, on the map, it still shows Fantasyland. And I've asked guest services, which there's a kiosk right there, and they said, we're in Fantasy, or we're in Frontierland. And I said, not according to the map. And they agreed with me that the transition is flawed in that area. So until they update the map, that is still my sticking point where the transition does not quite work as well.
This is why Amanda and Kevin and we're in the park. Like, this is why there's so much value in the stuff that they do, because they pay such close attention to detail that Amanda would notice something like this. So we appreciate that.
Also, for us with the games, we try to like mark where things are in the park. We have where we can like scan a code and it'll tell you like which land it's in. So it's tough when the transition between the two lands is unclear on which land you're in. But
yeah,
but it's still fun though, because if you ignore that, the fact that it's pink on the map, you do feel the transition from one world to another as you're going through there, because the sounds change. You have big thunder roaring past you to the one side. The weird thing is Galaxy's Edge is kind of, I think the transitions are wonderful, they're amazing, but they're kind of super subtle, where it's almost to a flaw, where you don't know where you're headed until you're in there.
Right.
And I personally, because I know about it, I knew where it was going to be before I got to the park. Walking through there, I love it, where it goes from all three of the transitions of Frontierland or from Critter Country into Galaxy's Edge are just masterful, like, works of transition, where the sounds change. You hear different sounds in like the plant life around you, where it's just like, I don't think I'm where I was a few seconds ago. And it's a gradual change until you get to where the actual action is happening, and you have stormtroopers and you have Chewbacca and the resistance there with their stuff.
But with the transition into Galaxy's Edge, that has a different transition that I don't feel in any other Disney park. That, I mean, I haven't been to all of them, but Galaxy's Edge is colder. So when you cross under any overhang, overpass to get into Galaxy's Edge, it is distinctly colder. So not only do you have the transition of sounds with the music changing, you have stuff rustling in the trees, you have the pavement changing, you have a lot of visuals, but you also have temperature change.
It's a little more shaded, I think, is all that's happening there.
No, but I'm saying like just entering into the land, I feel a significant temperature change that I don't feel anywhere else.
I don't know if I feel that in Florida, though, when we go there during...
I even felt it in Florida, yeah.
Really? It still feels hot to me there.
Well, no, it's still- I agree. I agree. There is a bit of a temperature change. And I think it might be because of the... Like, honestly, like, you're coming straight out of Toy Story. Like, well, depending what side you enter into. Like, but coming out of Toy Story Land, which is literally hot as, for lack of a better word, balls, because there's no shade. Everything is like this shiny reflective metal that is supposed to replicate plastic. But when you go into Galaxy's Edge, it has more of this, like, you're walking into a cave-esque feel, and caves are cooler. So there definitely is a transition from Toy Story Land to Galaxy's Edge in Florida, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
With transitions, though, and talking about Galaxy's Edge, one transition I think they failed on was going between the two sides of Galaxy's Edge. Having the Rebellion and the First Order, you really don't... There is no difference between the two sides, except for one has Kylo's ship and then the other one has X-Wings. There's no real obvious signs. I mean, most of the characters walk through the marketplace. And they were really trying to build that, like, what side are you on? And there's no real sides. Mildly, the First Order, where Kylo's ship and that little store there, you get that same vibe. But everywhere else, I mean, that's the only little spot. Everything else, all three entrances are pretty much the same. So Galaxy's Edge's transitions from the park into Galaxy's Edge, I think those are the better of the entrances. But when you're in Galaxy's Edge, it just feels like one cohesive land. There is no transitioning from the First Order side to, is it the Rebellion? Is that what it's called? on the opposite side, there is no real key differences. I mean, even the uniforms and the costumes for cast members are either you're an attraction person, a food person, or a custodial. Their costumes aren't different, and that was one thing that they were supposed to share in the D23 was wherever you're at in that land, their outfits may be different depending on what side they are working with. And I haven't noticed that. If it's there, I missed it.
I mean, it's all bad too. So you have that going for right. it. But the people working in the shop over by the, I don't know what the ship is called, the Kylo ship over there, I believe they're dressed differently than the people running the Rise of the Resistance attraction.
No, attractions and like commerce and custodial, their outfits are all different. But like the store in the First Order side and the marketplace stores, their outfits are the same. Your commerce
kind of in like Batuan clothing with like the funny hat.
Well, yeah, because like, they were like talking about that it was supposed to be different. You wouldn't be able to like tell, like you, it'd be a seamless transition. And when you went into Galaxy's Edge or Batuu, it would really feel like you are one of that community. And I feel like that transition, the physical transitions are great. The storytelling transitions, I think, are mildly lost in that land.
Yeah. Well, I know like over on the Resistance side, it's supposed to be like an area outside of Blackspire Outpost.
Right.
So it's still Batuu, but it's not the outpost anymore, which is kind of what that point of that little walkway you have is to feel like you're on the outskirts of town.
Right.
Better or worse.
Yeah. But to that point, the average person doesn't pick that up. So like to our point where we were saying in the beginning about Galaxy's Edge is the idea was there. The execution was not 100% to get us there. And I will make the point as far as the transitions go, depending on which side you come in from, the tracks are different in the concrete. So next time you go, check out the tracks. So you're going to see different robots. You're going to see different treads. You're going to see different boots. You're going to see different things that kind of, if you're picking up on it, will kind of guide you into like what area you are heading into, whether that be First Order or otherwise. So there's, but again, it's, if you know, you know.
Super subtle. I mean, exactly. Like I said, that's kind of what they're going for, but right. Almost to a fault. Yeah.
So.
All right. I think we're ready to move into our next section of the pyramid, which is my section. And I think one that pretty much anybody who has ever seen any footage of Imagineering ever is pretty familiar with, storyboarding. So basically storyboarding is putting all of the timeline or order of events in order, which they can move around, and they include the weenies in this, what is going to draw you through the story to keep a visitor engaged. So it's taking the big picture, breaking it into smaller moments, and guiding those smaller moments on a physical board. Which, Lewis, I'm curious. Do you ever think about storyboarding in your art? Or like when we, even in podcast planning, like, or in Amanda and Kevin, Where in the Park, do you guys ever plan out your big picture with the smaller steps?
I do.
I knew you would, Amanda. I knew you would. Cause I know the way that your brain is. Amanda is, she's so creative, but she also is able to balance it with that like left side analytical ability. That is something that I strongly lack in. So I value that in you and Amanda. I value that.
Thanks.
But I don't have that. So my storyboards look more like vision boards. And they're not as clear and concise. And I have all of these ideas slapped up together. And they're not in an order that makes sense. That is something that Imagineering is able to fix by having different people on staff who are all part of the same project. Because you're going to have people whose brains are like mine. And you're going to have people whose brains are like Amanda. I just, here's my ideas. I have so many ideas. Let me slap them on the board. Then you have somebody who comes in and they're like, well, let's make sense of this. Let's put this in a sequential order. Let's drive the ride vehicle through the right order. So storyboards are incredibly valuable to Imagineering. They use them for everything. All of the footage we've seen for Imagineering, they are working on storyboards, essentially. So storyboarding, incredibly important. But they also say, like, for any in the book, Lou Prosperi says, any creative project you're working on, you need to map out your big picture this way. Do we agree or disagree?
Yes, absolutely. But that's just for my brain. If I don't have an outline of some kind, if I don't have a storyboard outline, I'm lost to the world.
I think I work more in outlines than storyboards. I usually don't draw out the things I'm going to be working on.
Well, yeah, yes, but you still have the story in it. You still have the story in like a sequential order, and if you need to move pieces around, you can.
Yeah, because you can copy. We live in a neat time where it's digital, where you digitally like just copy and paste something to another spot or cut and paste. So it's not like back in the day, if you had an outline, you were kind of stuck with that, and you had to like start drawing like lines through things and making a mess, which is, I'm sure, why they did the storyboarding instead of an outline back in the day, was because you couldn't just erase the outline, you know. It was more of a quick fix rather than just what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but if you think of it as like, it doesn't have to be a visual representation of what it is that you're going to say. It's just having a way to organize your thoughts or organize your project. So like, you can have it as words in an outline. But that is your storyboard. What is the order in which things are going to happen?
So whether that's yes. So I think that technique works well for storyboarding for our types of projects. But as far like to tie it into Lewis's topic of the night and even Amanda's, because they literally map out the transitions, they map out the weenies. It is a more visual physical thing because they are giving us a visual product, and our projects that we are working on are not as outstanding as, not that you guys aren't fantastic. You guys are, you're absolutely amazing. You're just not creating the same atmospheric experience that's required for a theme park attraction or a theme park land. So I think when it comes down to Imagineering storyboarding, that's why there's always that visual aspect. But yeah, Kevin, as far as our goals and the things that we work on as not theme park creators, we can, and it is still visual. It is still visual, though. You are still seeing your outline with your eyes. You're still able to see your bigger picture, to see your smaller steps, to see where your goals are leading you to. And that's the whole point of a storyboard, is to see the big picture and all the small steps that are going to get you there.
I understand storyboarding attractions. I can't remember. Did they go into storyboarding actual lands?
They did not in the book. They talked about how the Imagineering Fields Guide is a good example of storyboard art for Cars Land and Monsters, Inc., Roger Rabbit's Cartoon Spin and Finding Nemo, Submarine Voyage, Dinosaur, and Fantasmic. And honestly, whoever thought that they were doing a good job storyboarding Dinosaur, bless their hearts. But
I was like, so for the storyboard, it's going to be completely black.
At some point, we're going to have references to ketchup and mustard. That's about all I get from Dinosaur.
I think that came after the storyboarding. That was
right. But I mean, there are times when you can look at storyboarding, like Claude Coates' storyboarding. I've seen phenomenal things come out of Claude Coates' storytelling and the storyboards that he's created. And all of our other Disney legends, like, we have access to looking at their storyboards online. If you Google easy enough, I mean, it's all there. Storyboard art is available. I think it's incredible. And it kind of like, for the fact that it's, these pictures were put together before the model was built, because, you know, we go from the storyboard to the model. It's incredible. That's incredible.
You don't want to confuse concept art with storyboards as well, though.
No, no. Concept art is, yes, absolutely. So original concept art is the main one or two pieces that they are going to give us to buy us into the topic. And then we use those pieces and we separate them into smaller sections to tell the story. And that becomes our storyboard art. And we have people who can move those pieces around and make sure that we're telling a cohesive story. So, for example, let's take Small World. They may have been moving different countries around in that storyboard art so that it looked more cohesive.
Probably a good one for storyboarding.
Yeah. Haunted Mansion would be a great one because do we put the ballroom scene here or do we move to the graveyard here? Like deciding how things are going to fall in an order that is able to tell the best story. And that's what's kind of cool is like you've got these people with different brains that come in and they're like, well, what if we do this and we do this and we do this? And like we can move these pieces all around. That's what makes storyboarding valuable. But I think we've beat. Do you think we beat that one to a pulp? Are we ready for our last topic?
I got some fun facts on that.
I am happy for your fun facts.
A lot of people attribute storyboarding back to Webb Smith, a Disney animator, back in the 1930s. According to Diane Disney Miller, it was first used in the 1933 Disney short "The Three Little Pigs." Before Webb Smith created that for "The Three Little Pigs," filmmaker George Méliès, he's a French director who created A Trip to the Moon and a bunch of other old silent films. He also famously used storyboards. So it kind of went from there to Disney. Then after Disney started using it, it kind of like went like wildfire and everyone started using it in filmmaking. And the final part of our pyramid is mine. It's combined pre-shows and post-shows.
Next element. Let's go, Kevin.
I think most of us who've been to the parks, like for me, when I hear pre-show, I think immediately of the Haunted Mansion stretching room, where it's an actual show element where you stood in a long line to get to a point and now a show element is happening. That is the pre-show before you go on the actual ride. In the book, it explains that there's a little more to it as far as how everything in the queue is pre-show. Everything in the land before you got to the ride is pre-show. You know, it's just getting you prepared for the attraction that you were going to go on. And to that point, it's also everything is post-show, where if you are successful enough to have it where your ride is in a land that fits it, it's going to feel like an extension of that attraction both before and after the ride. In California, I feel like there aren't as many literal post shows. Whereas over in Florida, you have like little interactive areas, like after the Figment Imagination ride, the Journey to Your Imagination with Figment, you have it where there's a little play area. It needs to be updated, but it exists. And it's the post show. You've shown how you use your imagination. Now you're going to keep using it as you go after the ride. And pre-shows, obviously over in Florida, they've gotten really good at it over there with their interactive queues, like for Winnie the Pooh and for Soarin', even out there where it's like a whole trivia thing about stuff around the world, getting prepared for the trip you're about to take around the world over there when it's not Soarin' over California. So it's just kind of a interesting way to look at the world where even the shops, which for a lot of us we see is kind of just like, you know, a way to make more cash for the parks. Sometimes it feels like that when you get out of a ride. It's like, why is there a shop right here, you know? But if it's done correctly, it extends the ride experience beyond the ride. I don't know if you guys have any insight into your favorite shops at the exit of a ride.
When I first read that part of the book, the first sentence I was like, really? I disagree that a retail shop is a post show. And his explanation of, you know, it's a keepsake that extends the experience long after you've left the park. Okay. I do think, though, it is... I think that... Okay. So I think in Buzz Lightyear Astro Blaster, not Space Ranger Spin, Astro Blaster, I think that that gift shop gives you more as far as the experience, but it's also the hidden details within that shop that make it so. So, for example, the reusing of the attractions from eons past, right? Those are represented as, you know, different shelving and the, what is it called? The registers. But those add to my experience when I go into that gift shop. So it's not so much buying something. It is what does that shop have to offer in terms of something that's going to continue the story or continue the experience. But for the most part, I don't like exiting through gift shops. It's but something to just bypass.
Like the post show is so weird. Like to think about a gift shop being a post show.
Yeah.
So my favorite pre show
does it well. I think Star Tours, yeah. The post show works for both, where you end up in like a kind of a saw where you can make a lightsaber or something, you know. And the one in Florida is definitely well themed.
Actually, yeah, like, they know, are. They are. Or whatever. But it kind of gives you the Disney ick because they're always trying to sell us something. That's why they drop us into them. So it takes us out of that. Wow. Like, and honestly, it's smart on their part. And I understand why they need to do it. They need to have that as their post show because we need to buy merch. Like merch keeps some things going for us. But I think just as fans of Imagineering, we just want more. So it's like, oh, what else can you do? Honestly, Frozen does a pretty good job. You've got the troll when you're coming out and all of that. And the pre-show for Frozen, you're going through like the little house there. So that's cute. My favorite pre-show, I think, is probably, I guess you could, Soarin'. Would you consider like Michael Warburton or like his speech like a pre-show?
Oh, absolutely. It's like a setup. It's like a, traditional airport setup.
You do know what I miss or really, really want back? It's the Rainbow Corridor as your pre-show for Journey into Imagination.
There's a lot of that, right? I would like to have back.
Yes. Like, and so much of it would be a perfect pre-show. And I mean, obviously, do we need Dreamfinder back?
It has a fun pre-show as you walk through like the laboratories and stuff. And, like,
yeah, you do, but it's not like Rainbow Corridor amazing. Kevin's like, I may disagree, but that's fine.
No, you're not wrong. 100%. It just, as far as like, yeah, I don't know. That ride needs so much of an overhaul. I don't even know where to begin with it.
Yeah, they just need Tony Baxter to come back and do it.
Sure.
He said he would. He said he would come back if they would let him do it the right way. They would give him.
Yeah, Tony.
Tony, come back. anything else anybody wants to say about pre or post shows before we talk about our next couple episodes?
The only thing I hate about pre and post shows that I wish they would do more is really utilize that when opportunities serve. One of the biggest things that I think misses the opportunity for that and would gain so much more foot traffic for it is PhilharMagic at DCA. The waiting room pre-show where you just got the movie theater cut out of Donald. Come on now. You got rid of Muppets for that. Now, granted, they didn't get rid of Muppets for that. It was all your when Disney was doing sneak previews of movies and like that. But the Muppets pre-show in there was so rad. You had all the little TVs, all the whole behind the stage type of setup. And then even when you're in the theater, I mean, there's nothing going on, and there's like, I think, 8 giant, like 8 feet by 12 foot screens on the side they could utilize it so much more. And some of it's just so small, hidden details they could add. And I think for some attractions, the pre and post show really makes it. Pirates, when you get in there, you see the boats coming around. You see the Blue Bayou. I mean, granted, it's not pre-show for it necessarily, but those little nods get it going. So I think Disney, the pre and post is such a key thing.
Honestly, I think meet and greets are a great post-show as well when they have characters standing outside of the attraction or like near the attraction. You can meet them. That's a great like post-show or even pre-show, depending on when you're seeing them.
Absolutely.
I think that's all we've really got for pre and post shows. But I do want to say, you know, when I said Tony come back, Tony will be coming back next episode. Because on our next episode of Imagine That, Tony Baxter is our Imagineering focus. So we will be bringing you things from Tony Baxter. We'll be talking about Tony Baxter. And we have an armchair Imagineering exercise that goes over this tier of the pyramid. Lou, are you going to tell us what that is? Because I know you said you've already got something planned.
Yes. So
this is the first time we're hearing this. So
bear with me. So I think what we should do is knowing each other and being Tony Baxter, I think it works perfect. Pick an attraction that has either a weak or non-existing pre and post show. And design. And what would we do to design a pre and post show for that attraction? It could be the attraction could be a show, or it could be an actual ride, but it has to be one of the two. It has to be something that can have a pre and post show. Can't be like, oh, the parade or the firework. Has to be some type of attraction,
like a show
or ride.
And it can't be a gift shop.
No gift shops. Can we say no gift shops as post shows?
Well, no. I if you can get in a creative way, I think everything's on the table.
So, Amanda, what if you exit into a gift shop experience that is like you're buying something, but it's not necessarily...
Well, because I'm thinking like Star Tours. That part, what Kevin said, and I'm going to throw this out there. If Star Tours' store at the end was like a space airway terminal for like food and concession stand where, yeah, you got the flight. You're grabbing snacks, stuff like that.
And what if it was like themed to like astronaut type food?
I think if you themed it to that, like Star Tours is one of the few ones that would work. Where like, hey, you exit the ride.
Kevin said, Sam, we are not eating dehydrated food.
But I think a store, if that's how creative you're going to get, I mean, you're probably going to be the weakest of the teammates. But I think if you're creating a pre and post show, whatever you want to choose, it's up to you.
Did you just call me weak? That's the second time tonight.
Absolutely. But I think it has to – we also got to keep it within the box of doable. We can't be like, yeah, when you get on a Star Tours, you're in space. Like, that'll be practical.
Listen, I eat dehydrated food when I'm hiking. Mountain House meals, you boil some water and your jet boil and you dump it in and then you have a real meal. So it's a real thing on Earth, Lewis.
But if you're boiling water, is that still dehydrated?
You hydrate it to eat it.
And you can get the dehydrated food at the end of Mission Space at Epcot.
Except for nobody wants to eat after Mission Space, just saying.
Nope.
Just there for the post show.
Just there, watch all the people throwing up. That's the post show on Mission Space. All the people throwing up.
So let's do this then. So how are we going to make it fun? Who are we calling out? Who's calling who out?
What are we calling people out for?
Yeah, you got to pick their spot. Not right now, but who are you picking their spot for, their attraction?
Oh, I think we should pick it right now because that way we have some time to... The brainstorm.
That's what I'm saying. So all right, Amanda, who are you calling out? Who are you picking their attraction for?
Oh, we are.
Oh, I'm picking yours all day, Lou.
All right, then here we go. Let's have it.
That means...
All right, then I'll pick Sam's.
Great.
Then I got Kevin's.
Then I've got Amanda's.
All right, Amanda, what's mine? I got to write it down. because I'll forget.
Well, we have to think about it, right? Or we're going to actually say it right now. We have to come up with something.
I thought we were going to say it right now.
No. We're going to put it in the chat, like in our group chat, because if we say it right now, then it's live on the podcast.
I see what you did there. That's great.
Right,
that's great, right now,
Amanda is picking for Lou. Lou is picking for Kevin. Kevin is picking for me, and I am picking for Amanda. And we will put those in our chat tonight at some point or tomorrow. Let's give each other 24 hours. You got to put in the chat by 24 hours.
Just a heads up. I'm only familiar with Disneyland and DCA, so that I'm kind of limited.
Sucks to suck. But I'm sure Amanda is capable of helping you figure that out.
When was the last time you were at Disneyland?
If Kevin were to give me a Disneyland one or a DCA one, I would figure it out.
I would figure it out too, but then I can't be as creative with it because I don't know the exact layout of it.
Google, YouTube.
Luckily, YouTube exists.
Oh, okay. So we're playing hardball. All right. Fair enough. All right.
Yeah.
I'm about to go to Tokyo.
Armchair Imagineering. You were thrown into the fire. Let's go. I'm about to go to Tokyo.
All right.
Yep.
All right. So that's wrapping it up. You hear it. We're going to be talking about Tony Baxter next year. We are going to be Armchair Imagineering pre and post shows for whatever we are picking for each other. And then when we come back to you in two episodes, so not after our first one here, our next episode, which is in 2 weeks. On episode seven, we will be talking about the third tier of the pyramid, which is forced perspective, readability, and kinetics. But I think that's all we have for this time. All right. Good show, y'all. How do we lead this out, Lou?
I forgot.
Oh,
imagine that. Imagine that.